This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And while Prime Minister Mark Carney seems to have abandoned the elbows up stance, it looks like it's working for Doug Ford. As you heard in Jeremy's news, he got a new $23 million deal to keep Crown Royal on the shelves after he famously poured out a bottle, getting wide coverage because of the closure of the bottling plant in the province. It's not clear that this particular deal is going to do anything to save those 200 jobs, but $23 million is $23 million still. And also a new deal with Coca-Cola, big investment in the Brampton plant. And again, we don't really know what that's going to do in terms of boosting permanent jobs. There are about 1,300 now, but it will create 500 construction jobs. So that is good news for the local area. We have people recovering from that horrible tragedy in Tumbler Ridge last week. And in terms of the politicians, they all seem to be getting credit for not trying to make political hay out of the event. It was very unified. It was very appropriate. But speaking of that, I wonder if it is helping the image of the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, because a lot of people consider him to be a very aggressive partisan attack dog, and he was very different in that time. So we will talk about that and more with our political panel. The line for texts and long-distance calls, 866-744-740. And yes, our local phone lines are operational again. And the numbers, 416-360-0740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, former Liberal Health Minister and Deputy Premier, Sherry DeNovo, a former NDP MPP, and Janet Ecker, former Ontario PC MPP and Finance Minister. Hi, everyone.
Hi, good Libby. Day.
Hi. Let us begin with Janet. And on this question, do you think that it's a terrible tragedy, but that is going some distance to soften the image of Pierre Poilievre, which looks like he needs to do?
Well, I think what people are seeing is that all of our politicians showed that they're real people when something like this happens. And they, I think they were all pretty, at least what I heard, they were pretty, they hit the nail on the head in terms of what they said and you know, didn't play politics and were just real humans emoting, if you will, some of them in tears. So I think Pierre was, well, you know, followed. He's a father. He's a, you know, a husband. And, you know, he can't help but identify with the terrible, terrible, terrible tragedies. So I was very pleased to see all of them, regardless of what party they were from, being real human beings who care. And that's, I think, hopefully something we'll see more, and not in a nonpartisan way. And hopefully we'll see more of that from politicians in Ottawa down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a time for unity, Sherry.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with Janet. I mean, this is exactly what our leadership should be doing, is to come together at times like this. It's exactly what they should be doing, is to show they're human and to empathize with the victims. I mean, this is one, I think this is the largest mass murder in Canada. I mean, Certainly, I think the Ecole Polytechnique. I mean, like there have been a few that we commemorate, and we're not a country of mass shootings and violence, especially against children. That's not who we are, and I think we showed who we are. Kudos to everyone, and a reminder that there are things more important than our party stripes.
Well, whenever I hear people saying that's not who we are, I'm thinking, well, maybe it is, at least to some extent, George. I have to say that when I first heard about it, one of my initial reactions was, this is some kind of very bad import from the United States. Would something like this have happened if we weren't constantly hearing about these shootings south of the border?
Well, I just want to comment there on the image that you mentioned. I think for me, I really found that quite unifying. Whether it's good for Pierre Poilievre or for Prime Minister Carney, I thought, and the Governor General, I thought it was really good for Canada, especially contrast against what we see so frequently. The thing is, I think sometimes because we talk about gun control, etc., we convince ourselves that we've made ourselves immune from guns being turned on innocent individuals. And there's lots of guns out there in Canada, not like in the United States, where it's one per person. And in many places, you can carry openly on a holster. I'm not saying it's like that, but those events in Tumbler Ridge really gave us what I imagine is a recipe of access to guns and maybe not enough access to mental health support or what have you. So it's a deadly formula in the United States, which is 9 times bigger by population or something. This is so regularized that the White House and other people try to find a way not to comment on each event, because every time you say the same thing day in and day out and do nothing about it, well, people draw a certain conclusion. So, we do have problems with gun violence. They pale in comparison to the circumstances in the United States. But we can't be too self-righteous about it, can we?
I agree. We can't be too self-righteous about it. Janet, there is some confusion around the circumstances. And a lot of people are questioning, how did this fall through the cracks? But I've also heard it described that actually authorities did what they were supposed to do. So this person, the shooter, was known to police. There had been violent incidents that brought police to the home. And the thing that I'm a little confused about is whether or not there were firearms that had been confiscated but returned to the family. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, I think we're probably going to have some sort of inquiry or follow-up just to make sure that all the details are known. Because as you write, Libby, there are some questions. It had been my understanding that the firearms had been possessed and then given back. I don't know. And I think we'll let the authorities do what authorities do after a terrible tragedy like this and try to, get all the facts out on the table. I think one of the big challenges, though, for both the mental health professionals and the police, there are probably dozens or more people out there with mental health issues in potentially explosive situations. Which one's going to go? Which one isn't? It's a judgment call. And you just don't know. And everything is 2020 in hindsight. We'll see whether there were extenuating circumstances. Perhaps people did make a mistake in this case and there were, better warning signs that they should have paid attention to. But I would think if we were to go to the local police departments in, let's say, downtown Toronto and say, how many of these potential situations are you aware of? We would be rather shocked at the numbers. So it's tough to call, and I don't want to second guess our armed forces folks who, from the reports we've heard to date, performed very well. I mean, the running into the building, trying to shut it down, the shooter down right away, all of those things seem to have been very, very wonderful things that they did to try and stop, the tragedy from being even worse.
Sherry, there's also the question of the legality of things, because if somebody is having a mental health crisis and they can only confine somebody for 48 hours before they're released. A lot of people, family members of people with severe mental health issues, complain about that because it's not adequate. And there are also legal issues, I'm assuming, surrounding the return of a firearm if it was confiscated. And you, as a minister, I mean, I'm sure that you run into mental health issues as well.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because as Janet was speaking, and your question about, you know, were there problems with the first responders, I have to say that for years and years, I fought at Queen's Park, and luckily was supported by the Liberal government and the Conservative Party. It was one of the first questions when Patrick Brown became a leader there, out of his mouth was to support this bill to extend PTSD as a workplace injury to first responders. You know, before that bill got passed, we did not have that in Ontario. And so you think of the ripple effect on the first responders in these situations. I mean, this is going to have ripple effects on the families, of course, but also on those who were at the scene. Whatever they did, you know, ultimately inquiries may find some mistakes or not, but we forget that, you know, these are pretty commonplace. I mean, going to domestics, you know, going to situations in people's homes are the most dangerous usually for police and first responders. And so when to give weapons back, I mean, I think these kind of get into places that are beyond our laws. We can't ever control it. In terms of folk being held on mental health issues, this is a common complaint I've heard from social workers, quite frankly. And so that bears looking at. And that, again, is within the medical, you know, area, is, you know, these are decisions made and fought for, lobbied for or not, on behalf of, again, more first responders in the mental health system. So, you know, I think there's some work to be done around that holding and not holding of somebody in severe crisis. And I think there's kind of growing a mass. I'm certainly feeling it among the social services, and we as clergy see it for sure. What do you do? We have to have more. We have to have more action around that, because we're seeing in Toronto, we're seeing stabbings on subways and things. These are mental health related issues, and we're not responding accurately.
Yeah, there was just one this morning. I mean, it was it's being characterized as a domestic dispute, but a very bad stabbing that put a couple of people in critical condition. George, you're a former health minister, so this whole question of the ability to confine people, to put them away for longer than 48 hours against their will.
Well, interestingly, I think on this subject, both Alberta and British Columbia have, if I have my history well, and if not, someone will correct me, have fairly recently introduced laws that do allow for that involuntary intake, where the context may be mental health or perhaps mental health and addiction. I haven't looked most carefully enough, but there is a bit of a pendulum swing on that, if you will. And it's very common in our country that one or two jurisdictions will lead, and over time, six, seven, or eight will follow. So that wouldn't surprise me, not in the least. Frequently, the hypocrisy in that position is the people that want to have that intake but don't want to actually pay for the implications of bringing those people basically into care. And this is, I think, a challenge all with homeless populations that have underlying addiction, is these are very, very expensive individual cases to deal with. So you can call for and demand involuntary lockup, but you have in the same breath, I think, the moral or the fiscal obligation to speak up and recognize that that's going to require more support in the system. With respect to the guns, as I read it, the owner of the guns petitioned for their return. So I think there will be a very, very interesting, let's say, evaluation of how that worked. And another feature that I found interesting and had forgotten about to some extent is that in British Columbia, as in Ontario, a person under 18 can be given the right to use arms for the purposes of hunting, etc., which obviously was an important part of the underlying culture in that part of our country. So I think there is a lot to be learned about the whole gun aspect of of this going forward.
Okay, people, I'm just going to remind everyone about the text line and the phone lines. You can text us at 866-744-740. That is also the long-distance phone line. And the local phone line is back, 416-360-0740. We've been talking about Doug Ford seems to have two victories. First, with a $23 million deal to keep Crown Royal on Ontario shelves. There's been some pushback on that because it's not really doing anything to save 200 jobs at the Diageo bottling plant that's going to be shut. Meanwhile, also a big investment from Coca-Cola in Brampton. But again, I'm not sure what that's going to do in terms of increasing permanent jobs. It's supposedly going to create 500 construction jobs. Is that kind of good enough, Janet, in terms of, you know, trying to do what is possible in our economy?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the reasons we've seen why Ford is still relatively popular is that populist touch he has. So, I mean, he's fighting for those jobs. You can argue about whether he should or shouldn't have done what he did, but he's fighting for those jobs and trying to make a point. And, you know, and I think people need to hear that and want to hear that. They want to know that somebody out there is trying to protect their back. I think we're going to see, I mean, it's hard to say this job got lost because of, you know, Trump or this economic factor or the company's pulling stuff. There's just so much that goes into a company deciding to shut down a plant. It's not a painless process for the company either to do it, certainly not for the workers, for sure. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this kind of stuff as two things. One, the Trump unpredictable stuff keeps happening. And secondly, as Canada across our country tries very hard to adapt. I mean, we're rushing to try and hopefully rushing to try and change just how everything functions to be less dependent on the United States. And that means a lot of disruption in a lot of communities. So it's good that somebody's trying to at least do something for them. I think that's good. And we'll go from there. But I think, unfortunately, our country is going to see a lot more of this, no matter how good our politicians are in terms of trying to change and adapt and pivot, to use our favorite word.
Well, a pivot is something that you do pretty quickly. And a lot of these things are not anything that is going to happen fast. There was, you know, Korea might start building more cars here. There's a big trade delegation, George, either on the way or arriving in Mexico. We want to strengthen our ties with Mexico, you know, and they are part of the trade deal. And, you know, Carney is reaching out to Europe. He's talking about doing a big turn in defense industries by trying to sell our stuff. And I'm thinking, well, to whom? I know that I think we used to sell bullets to the United States. I don't know how much that is continuing, George. But, you know, all of this, again, is very long term.
You know, just on that Ford and Diageo thing, I think they had each other over the proverbial barrel, because Ford had made a lot of histrionics about it, but the fact that it was a Canadian product inside those bottles was a bit of a compromiser to his position overall. And Diageo obviously can't be in a situation where the largest single purchaser of alcohol in the world is out of sorts with them. So I think the conditions were there for some improvement. I think that there's a lot of evidence that people are taking Carney seriously, or he's taking the situation seriously, and significant efforts are being made both to create new strategic sectors and to find new markets for Canadian products. It's not going to mean that you can easily replace the U.S., et cetera. We all know that, but I think there's a lot of excellent evidence. And to your question about who's going to buy our stuff, well, Europe's going to buy our stuff, and we're going to buy their stuff, because we signed on to some pact that includes $150 billion, if I understand it well, in increased expenditure, and a bank to back that up or something. So I do think that's a very sensible and strategic play. You know, there are American military manufacturers in Canada that operate on these terms that are like basically from after the Second World War that guarantees them business and guarantees them profits, etc. I'm very convinced there are excellent Canadian manufacturers and sectors that are going to emerge here, and Europe will be our purchaser. To me, it's one more clue, and I may be wrong, that Canada is going to end up with a blended fleet of aircraft. Military aircraft.
Well, that's right. That's one of the big questions, a blended fleet. And we know that there are some, shortcomings with the Swedish aircraft. But let's leave that aside for now. And also, boy, you know, military purchasing is, if there's anything that's long term, it's that. It's long term to begin with. And then in the past, as soon as there were headwinds about the spending, it would be put on hold or canceled. I want to talk about regular inflation. So we saw some numbers this morning and said, gee, inflation eased a little bit at the end of the year. But even then, when grocers don't have their big markups, food inflation was up. And that is what most people feel day to day, Sherry.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, if you look at the profits, especially the profits during COVID, which I think sting a little, of the large, chains of supermarkets and their owners, that people are shocked and angry. Very, very angry about that. So this is a political hot potato. But I also wanted to comment on Carney's New Deal, because I'm no liberal, as we all know. But I have to say kudos, because this could realign really trade in the world. I mean, I know it's small steps now, relatively speaking, the United States being the center of all economic activity. But I think it's huge. And this is not only Europe. This is looking at, we're going to have a world realignment on trade in the economy that I think is really absolutely important. So I just wanted to say that. And ditto, I mean, maybe the theme of this panel should be that, you know, working across the aisle, because we're all in agreement. But yeah, and to Janet's point, yeah, I mean, every time somebody does something, the fact that Wab Kanu, you know, kind of said, you know, positive things about Doug Ford and Crown Royal, this is a moment, right? So, I mean, this is a moment where I think as Canadians first, really, is where we're all at. So kudos to all of what's happening, and perhaps this bodes for better working across the aisle in the future.
Still with the whole business of food inflation, and I think it is one of the keys why people are finding life so unaffordable. And there was an increase in restaurant meals, and this is top of mind because over the weekend we saw that, a neighborhood restaurant that was always busy and that has been there for years was shuttered with no notice. And there's been a recent warning from the Restaurant Association that a large number of restaurants are going under, and it's because of the costs. But also, I mean, if you've been out at all, the cost is staggering for what you get to go out to eat. I think I was talking about this earlier this week. We were out and it was, the senator across the street from the theater. I didn't realize you needed a reservation at 5 o'clock. They did us a big favor to let us in. And again, you know, a couple of drinks and a hamburger, and it's $100. And I'm thinking, gee, the place is crowded now. That's great, but who can afford this, George?
I think that's one point. But I think that COVID shifted behaviors as well. I live in a large condominium, and it's like the 401 here with food delivery coming in and out, and people turn a meal into 35, or like the food delivery with all of the markups on that can also turn like, wow, one basic meal into a very expensive thing. So I think it is about the financial means, but I think it's also about people, you know, being less interested in, you know, having dinner in congregate settings or wanting to be glued to their damn screens. So I think that there are a lot of significant shifts in behavior. Think about the way that our street fronts are going to change. Many blocks, 6 out of 10 shops or something like that, could be food service related, etc. And look in Toronto, street after street, neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood. I think another point of it is not always the case that these businesses have an easy generational transfer. Because if you were successful in one of these restaurant businesses, that's a hard life on the long term. I know lots of people that have done it. My hat is off to them, because those are difficult businesses to be successful in. And I think also quite difficult to pass along to the next generation frequently.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another thing. We're running out of time, not time to discuss this. But every kind of neighborhood strip that you pass, there are so many shuttered businesses with for sale signs. It really is, I think, sad and scary, Janet.
Yes, and I think government can do something for that. I mean, taking a look at the tax structure, especially on alcohol. I mean, there's an automatic excise tax that goes on our alcohol in this country, and it's really adding to costs. And that's something government could fix very, very easily to help, because the whole restaurant industry, as we've been reading, is in serious shape. I mean, those margins are pretty thin at the best of times. And so it's nice to see that they're full, but they're not necessarily covering their costs. And they employ a lot of people. I mean, that's, and they can be starting jobs for students, etc. So it's a piece of the economy that I think governments at all levels need to pay attention to. What are they doing to help? Because there are things they could do to help.
Okay, you know, I hate to end things off on a negative story like that. We didn't get to the Olympics. We have an increasing medal haul, including some golds, which is great to watch and I think is giving us a big sense of unity. So let's wrap things up on that note. And of course, let's keep our fingers crossed, especially for our hockey teams. Thank you so much, George Smitherman, Janet Ecker, and Sherry DeNovo.
Go Canada, go!
Yes, and bye, Libby.
Bye-bye. Go Canada, go. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, you know, this morning I was saying one of the best pieces of news over the weekend is that Fred Hahn, virulent anti-Semite, in my opinion, announced he's not running again for one of the top jobs in one of the top unions in CUPE, where he has been the president, undisturbed after, you know, praising October the 7th, among other incidents. So we'll talk about this when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, just about the best news on my weekend was that Fred Hahn, a virulent anti-Semite, in my opinion, is not running again for one of the top jobs or several of them at CUPE, which is one of the largest public sector unions. And now, he is, of course, the guy who praised the October 7th massacre the morning, the very morning after it happened. He followed up with this video depicting an Israeli diver at the Summer Olympics as a bomb on civilians. And he is still the president of CUPE Ontario. They say, gee, we couldn't do anything. And he says, oh, no, I'm really not anti-Semitic. I'm just anti-Israel. It just boggles the mind, the defenses of this. And as I said, he lost his job on the national executive, but he is still president of CUPE Ontario. He will go out, presumably, with a great pension, with goodbye parties, with well wishes. So, you know, I say good riddance, but shame on CUPE for not doing something about this before and for allowing basically the clock to run out. This guy's been in place for 20 years. And, you know, it is, I have to say, not just QP. Anti-Semitism has become normalized in a lot of our unions, particularly public sector unions, and particularly, and I think most dangerously, in education unions, where, you know, harassment of Jewish students is kind of standard and, you know, often, sometimes, perpetrated by teachers. So, what do you think? The text and long-distance phone line, 866-744-740. The local call line, 416-360-0740. And now let's go to Carrie Silverberg, an education worker who's a member of QP, and employment and human rights lawyer, Catherine Marshall. Thank you both so much for joining us. Hello.
Hi.
Let's begin with Carrie. So this is your union. What's your reaction to this?
Well, to be honest, I'm not that surprised, but I am very happy. It's well past time that we have some new leadership with some fresh ideas and some fairness, and we try and remove some of this, or all of this, hate that seems to be driving QP Ontario for so long. So we're quite pleased. Would have been nice for him to be voted out, but still happy he's gone or going.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, Carrie, just before we move on to Catherine, I mean, what do you make of the fact that QP Ontario said, gee, we can't do anything about it? I'm just trying to think if the target of his wrath was, you know, people of color or any other kind of minority group, I think they would have figured out that they could do something.
Oh, yeah, of course they could do something. They just chose not to. And they have every ability to have taken a stand and, you know, caused Mr. Han to resign a long time ago. But they just they chose not to. And none of this is new. I mean, Mr. Han has been saying hateful things for many years, well before October 7th. They just actually had media exposure for the first time and had a lot of public scrutiny on it. So it's time for QP to do the right thing and turn a chapter. We released a statement today about it. And maybe Carrie can tell you a little bit more about that. But this is their chance to do the right thing.
Carrie?
Well, yes, I am cautiously optimistic, hopeful that more reasonable people will put their names forward and we'll have a true, fair election at the convention in May, because that's the way it works. And unfortunately, that means that only a very, very small percentage of members actually have a voice in that. So it's still, as far as I'm concerned, not so democratic, but I'm hoping that there'll be reasonable people that can see what's going on and really just want to bring this back to, like, the union back to being a union and not like a foreign affairs department, and you know, get down to union matters for members and workers in Ontario.
Catherine, I mean, some of the explanations I've heard, it's the way the rules are, that Han had control of the people who were the delegates, only the delegates could vote. I mean, it just sounds like a bunch of excuses.
Oh, definitely. Like, you know, they could have passed an emergency motion to remove him. I mean, surely there needs to be some, there are some kind of, like, rules or perimeters of appropriate public conduct if you're in a role with that organization. So the fact that they said they couldn't do anything, that was definitely a cop-out. That was an excuse. I believe they didn't remove him earlier because they didn't want there to be a perception that they were giving in to people who were saying, you guys are being wrong. They didn't want to admit that they were doing something wrong by enabling him, but they were. So it was disappointing, though, that, you know, Mr. Han got to release this obnoxious departure statement, you know, saying it's all in his terms. And even within his own statement, he says some offensive things.
Oh, boy. I missed that. What can I say? Catherine, it's not just QP. So two things. So first of all, it seems to me that anti-Semitism has become normalized, especially in education unions. And, you know, the larger context is, what are they doing spending their money and their energy on things that have nothing to do with the day-to-day concerns of their members? And again, I'm especially worried about some of these education units. And there are incidents where Jewish students are harassed, sometimes even assaulted, and nothing is done because of, I'm putting this in air quotes, intergenerational trauma or whatever is unpunished. And sometimes it's the teachers who are the perpetrators, Catherine. Catherine?
Yeah, there is. Yes. Yes. Look, this is a pervasive issue. There's a lot of workplaces where people are not safe. Teachers are not safe. Education workers are not safe because their unions are not doing anything to protect them from the anti-Semitism, from fake complaints from students, from being targeted and harassed in their own work environments. And think again to the fact that these are people who are trying to do the most important thing in society, which is to teach and educate our children and our future generation. And they're going to work and they're crying, they're unsafe. And they're, you know, I've got them as clients. They're coming to my office and I'm hearing some brutal, terrible stories. So there's going to be a reckoning around all of this.
Well, I mean, let's hope so. Carrie, what is it? Is it just that people with these views have seem to have, you know, seized control of a bunch of unions? I mean, why?
I would like to hope that it's a minority of people, but unfortunately, they're very loud people and they seem to they drown out the more reasonable people, or people are afraid to come forward and speak. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to that I've, you know, if they're going to convention and I've said, you know, you need to go speak. Oh, no, I can't do that. Because there's a real fear from our union. And these are the people that are supposed to be there to be, you know, championing our freedoms and making sure that we're safe. And they're the ones that are making us feel the most unsafe.
Catherine, what makes you sure that there will be a reckoning? And in terms of you're saying people are your clients, what is the burden of some kind of proof? How difficult are these cases?
Well, we've got the ongoing case against QP and Fred Hahn and the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario, which Carrie Silverberg is involved with, as well as dozens of other Jewish unionized members. So that case is going to eventually go to a hearing. And despite the fact that Mr. Hahn will not be involved in the QP anymore, he will still be a defendant and have to answer to us in court. There are other cases that are planned. I can't get into the specifics right now just because they're still private. They're not public yet. But these are cases that are not easy. I'm not going to lie. All cases involving human rights for Jewish individuals are difficult. And that's because we have a system in this country that really has not treated Jewish people like a group of individuals who are being discriminated against. We have just different rules for everyone, right? There's a reason why you see hateful protests walk down the street and the police are just standing there watching them and protecting them. So that permeates to the law, to the legal system, but we're confident we're going to win. We're going to fight it. And this is how you get change. This is how things start to change, not from even the law point of view, but to societal.
And what is a timeline for at least the first of those cases to get to court?
Oh, I don't think we're going to be in court for years. I mean, we launched this case over 2 years ago. We're still in the early stages. The courts are so slow. They're so backlogged. So it's going to be years, but that's okay. We're prepared to fight for years. I mean, this has been going on for a really long time. And this is going to be, I think, a very precedent-setting case. It's going to be a really important case. So justice is never swift. I mean, especially when you're fighting through our court system, which is notoriously delayed. But, you know, Carrie Silverberg and the other clients, they're very committed, passionate people who are not going to stop till we have our day in court.
Carrie, I'm going to give you the last word. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, I'd like to first thank Catherine for helping us fight so hard and helping us bring this forward, because without her, we would have been lost, I think. But it's unfortunate that our court system is so slow. It's been over 2 years, and we're working on it, but we're not giving up. We will keep fighting. And even with Fred gone, Fred needs to answer to what he did, and QP Ontario needs to take responsibility for what they did. So we will keep fighting, and as long as it takes, we'll be here.
Okay, well, good to hear. Thank you so much, Carrie Silverberg and Catherine Marshall. Thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
Okay, we are taking another break, and when we come back, it is the Lunar New Year, the Chinese New Year. It is the year of the horse, and not just any horse. It's the year of the fire horse. We'll talk all about it when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Happy Lunar New Year, everyone. Gong Hei Fat Choi. It is the year of the horse, the fire horse, to be exact. And millions of people around the world and here in Canada are celebrating, and I am fascinated with some of the traditions I'm learning about around the new year. So let's go to our experts. We've got Judy Hsu, who is a professor of Asian Studies at the University of Windsor, and Angela Chan, president of the Chinese Cultural Center of Greater Toronto. Thank you both for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, let us begin with Judy. So what's the significance of the year of the horse and of the fire horse?
Oh, this year is, we are lucky, this year is a fire horse, and especially from, you know, the humble snake. So with the fire horse, we're supposed to be very energetic and independent, of course, we will do hardworking, and then we will take the adventurous, and also, you know, many people will take the natural leadership to lead the world, to leap forward.
My understanding, Angela, is that it's a very optimistic sign. Is it good for prosperity?
Oh, yes, definitely. Because of the energy and stamina, it's also moving things forward, which I think is very important for us now. And then it sort of gives you a sense of quickness and speed when you talk about the horse, right?
And what are some of the pitfalls that you have to watch out for in the year of the fire horse? Judy.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. So actually, you know, in this year, usually we see people would have a strong willed and independent thinkers. They are, and the natural leaders. So especially for the kids, if they were born in this year, we would like to encourage their independence, but guide them with, you know, the structures, and also because they are full of energy. So we would like to channel their energy into sports, arts, or leadership roles, and those things to, you know, guide them to the right direction. And also teach the kids, you know, to keep their emotional balance alongside the ambitious, because usually they are very ambitious. And as a parent or adult or as the educators, we would like to, keep them balanced and to encourage them to achieve their ambitious goals.
Angela, the years go in 12-year cycles. So I gather that a year of the horse is particularly good for people born in a year of the horse. So who is going to be the luckiest this year?
Well, I think people born in year of the horse is considered very lucky. Most of them, but of course, I think they would need to check in on their because of the speed they do things. As the doctor just said, it's the impulsiveness. Have to check that, and also they may be overly emotional, as horses are. They are loyal, but a bit emotional. So that's what they have to be careful of. Yeah.
And what other of the signs, Angela, are going to have a good year or a particularly good year? What other of the symbols?
No, I haven't studied that yet. But normally they are good and bad signs of the horse, affecting the other signs, animal signs, right? Yeah.
Judy, Judy, do you know which other signs do well in a year of the horse?
I think, you know, we should take the advantage of this horse year, especially with the fire, and we should, you know, set bold but meaningful goals. Just like Angela says, because, you know, usually those people are really going fast and emotional, so we should encourage them to set up bold goals, but meaningful goals, and also take actions. Something probably you have been postponing for a while, and it is time to take action now. And also, you know, we encourage people to step outside your comfortable zone and to take initiative. And to start with your new project, and also say yes to the opportunities, and grasp it, and you know, make it into your reachable goals, and also lead with the passion. But you know, we always need to remember the balance.
I was very happy when I read some of the traditions, like you can't do laundry today and you're not supposed to wash certain things. Can you explain that, Angela? You're laughing.
Yeah, because we have many traditions and customs during before and after, like during the Chinese New Year. Definitely. I remember my mom, like she has to clean all the cleaning she has to do and cooking before days before the Chinese New Year. And then because on the day of, like today, the actual day, we don't even sweep the floor because we want to keep whatever is in there, because everything that's not wanted, rubbish, should be thrown out the night before. Okay. So this is what one of our traditions when we were in Hong Kong. And of course, we also have very symbolic foods as well during the Chinese New Year. Like fish is a necessity because fish means in Chinese, yu means abundance. It's the sang, the sang meaning abundance. And then we also have lobster because lobster is full of life. And also green vegetables, which means money,
well,
fortune.
I've cooked some of that. The fish, the whole fish with the ginger and scallions, delicious. There's also, Judy, noodles, longevity noodles. You have to eat things that are long. Judy?
Very true, yeah. So, because, you know, this is just symbolic, but if you believe it, then, you know, it will guide your behavior, right? So then it will, you know, lead you right to that. And, like noodles, it means, you know, it's long and also wish you longevity, right? And then, you know, like other symbols. There are a lot of traditional food in China, and from different region, we also have different food because China is so big, just like in Canada, right? And also we have
different provinces have different foods.
And what are some of the other foods? It's lunchtime.
Dumplings. Gaozi.
And any particular kind of dumplings?
Well, dumplings, stuffed dumplings, either with meat or vegetables, or is stuffed because, as you see, dumplings looks like the gold ingots, and then so it symbolizes gold, like it's fortune when you eat dumplings during the Chinese New Year. And of course, a lot of seeds as well, seeds like lotus seeds, sesame seeds, because seeds in the Chinese language is ji, which means sons. You have a lot of sons, descendants, let's say.
Descendants. Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yes, some seeds, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And dumplings, one of the things that I recently introduced to are those soup dumplings. Are they for the New Year?
Oh, yes. Any kind of dumplings, you can have fried, steamed, or soup dumplings. Uh-huh. Yeah, because every province in China, they may make their dumplings differently, but still they are dumplings. Like they're wrapped, like they wrap something inside, and that makes it the shape of a gold ingot.
Okay, we have less than a minute left. I know that I was actually going to wear something white today, but that's a no-no, so I'm wearing red. Red is lucky, right?
Yes, and gold.
Red means, you know, ward off the bad spirit. And
both of us are in red.
Yeah.
Okay, well, ladies, you look like you are having a wonderful time. I hope you have great plans for tonight. Thank you so much for being with us and for explaining the year of the fire horse. Gong hei fa choy.
You too, Gong hei fa choy. Wishing you good health, happiness, and prosperity.
Thank you so much.
Good luck in the new year.
Yeah. Good luck.
Wishing you healthy and
thank you.
Prosperity.
And wishing everybody good health and prosperity in the new year. That is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. I'll be here tomorrow and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.